Hello and welcome to the Physician Financial Success Podcast. My name is Josh Metal, and this is the podcast dedicated to advising physicians how to avoid financial landmines. Today, we'll be talking with Dr. Stephen Podnos, principal of WealthCare LLC, a registered investment advisor and fee-only fiduciary firm. Dr. Podnos was awarded his Bachelor's of Science and his medical degree at the University of Florida. His postgraduate training included a residency and fellowship at the University of Texas Southwestern Medical School and is currently boarded in internal medicine, pulmonary medicine, and critical care medicine. Along with a 20-year private practice of pulmonary medicine, Dr. Podnos earned a master's in business administration from Regis University in 2003. He's a certified financial planner, and as certified retirement plan specialist, he's overseen investment accounts for over two decades. To top it off, Dr. Podnos is also a lieutenant colonel and flight surgeon in the U.S. Air Force Reserve Medical Corps. Happy day after Veterans Day to you, by the way, Stephen.
Thank you.
And welcome to the show. I am truly excited for our chat. I would love to just jump right in, and what strikes me as I read about your professional background is how diverse it is, and I would love to hear just a little bit from you about your journey and how you came to serve physicians with WealthCare LLC.
Well, Josh, let me say first, thank you very much for having me on the show, and I've listened to a number of your podcasts, and they're great. You're doing physicians a great service.
Thank you.
Sure. Well, you know, I was practicing medicine in the late 90s and beginning to get a little disgruntled with a lot of the changes that have gone on continuously. And I started a hospitalist program using my pulmonary group. I had to deal with the hospital financial people and felt at a disadvantage, which led to an eventual MBA. But while I was studying business, I came across an article talking about fee-only financial planning, which I'd never heard of. Up to that point, you know, I was stuck talking to stockbrokers and insurance agents and other, quote, advisors, and usually feeling somewhat taken advantage of. So I went and talked to the only fee-only planner in the county and became intrigued that it seemed a model much like medicine, very ethical, advice-related, really little to no conflicts of interest. So I began the CFP, Certified Financial Planner curriculum, and opened a part-time practice around 2001, 2002. And as I got busier and busier, I had to kind of make the decision to change careers, which my group was wonderful enough to let me do.
Well, I find your path intriguing and unusual, and I suspect it gives you a specialized knowledge that few others in the financial planning field could possibly have. Can you tell us just a little bit about how your unique background contributes to your ability to give advice and to counsel your clients today?
Sure, Josh. Well, I mean, part of being a physician, I think, in a sense, is being a trusted advisor. I think that's incredibly important in getting financial advice as well. The whole element of trust is important. I'm lucky enough to have a lot of experience both in running a medical practice and being a physician, so I know a lot of the issues that are certainly unique to physician issues, although they really extend over to all types of families and all types of businesses, very common problems and issues in families. I raised a family myself. I have three grown children, which gives me some experience with those issues of educational planning and raising children. Certainly our private practice was a business, which gave me some business experience. I think all of those parts of the background certainly help.
Absolutely. And, you know, specifically for younger physicians, you have traveled the path that lays before them. So I think that definitely would give you a unique perspective. And to that end, let's talk a little bit about the differences between the field of medicine and financial advising. One of your articles is titled The Physician Financial Advisor's Hippocratic Oath. So tell us a little bit about that article and what to be cautious of with most financial advisors.
Well, Josh, first, I would say there's a lot of similarities in fee-only ethical financial planning and medicine. So, you know, the classic way medical students learn to deal with patients is to do what's called a SOAP note, S-O-A-P. So you take a subjective data, you know, what's the patient complaining about, or what's the financial issue a family may be having. You do an objective evaluation of a patient by examining them and looking at their labs and past history. And in financial planning, you look at investment statements and estate planning documents, insurance face sheets as the objective part of the phase. Mm-hmm. Then in both medicine and financial planning, you make an assessment and recommendations and a plan that follows in terms of how to help solve the problems and issues, whether it's medical or financial. So I find a tremendous amount of overlap there. In terms of that specific article, I was focusing on one of the most shocking things to me as I went into financial planning was the confirmation of just how unethical most of the field is. Mm. So that I find that the overwhelming number of, quote, advisors out there are really salespeople. They are hired by various brokerage houses or bank brokerages, or they may be, quote, independent but are selling a product, and that's how they make their living. And it sets up an adversarial relationship with the client. They come out ahead by selling things that pay them the best rather than doing what is best for the client. In addition, you find that the overwhelming percentage, and I'm talking well into the high 90s, of, quote, advisors are really not giving any real advice other than buying some investments for the client. They're not asking, you know, about family issues and goals and such. They're really just figuring out what's the quickest way to get some money and buy something that pays a commission. And I put in this article, I said, you know, physicians have to take a Hippocratic oath to do no harm and to put the patient ahead of their own interests. And wouldn't it be nice if financial advisors had to do the same? And it turns out there is a group in the country of less than 2,000 planners that have taken a fiduciary oath and are fee only. And that has to be differentiated by a trick called fee-based that you'll often see. But fee-only planners, and especially if they belong to an organization called NAPFA, which is NAPFA.org or .com, they are have sworn to be fiduciaries, to be paid only by the client, and to give impartial client-centered advice.
Explain to us and just make abundantly clear to our listeners, if you would, the difference between fee-only and fee-based. And maybe even if you could put a practical application together for me so you could, you know, of a particular client maybe you're dealing with and how the compensation package or strategy or what the advisor would receive would differ between the two strategies.
Sure. In a fee-only environment, typically the advisor will charge an assets under management fee for managing assets. There may or may not be a separate fee for actual developing a financial plan, but this is disclosed up front. It is transparent. It is separated from the purchase or of any investments at all. It's very clear. There are never products purchased that are paying the advisor a back-end load or a surrender charge or a commission or a trip to Hawaii or anything else like that. Fee-based is, in my mind, a trick. Fee-based is planners who would like to have fee associated with their titling but it is in fact allows them to come up with whatever compensation scheme pays them the best. So they may have seen fee-based planners who have, you know, had clients come over to me, and what you see is that they're charging a fee, maybe a wrap fee or a flat fee per year. And then on top of that, they're buying investment products that are paying what are called 12B1 fees or other, you know, benefits to the brokerage house or to the broker or both, along with the fee they're charging the client. Fee-based advisors also retain the right to do straight commissions with sometimes very high costs to the clients. I think it's a very misleading term, and it's done so on purpose.
So if someone were fee-based, then part of their compensation may be wrapped into the total return of the portfolio and maybe shielded in some way. So that hypothetically, my statement at the end of the quarter, at the end of the year, says that I made an 11% return. But in reality, there was a couple of percent or however many basis points somewhere shielded off so that I didn't see it and there wasn't full disclosure. Did I get that right?
In a sense. I mean, what I have found in general with both brokerages and, quote, fee-based planners is there is a tremendous effort to obscure returns and costs. So it is common to look at these, you know, 30 and 50 and 60 page brokerage statements, and you can't find anywhere in there what any of the costs have been, what any charges have been. They're all internal. They're all kind of deducted out of purchases. It's really very misleading. It's also very unusual to find a real performance that's accurate. They may show that the account value is going up, but not telling the client, you know, compared to any benchmark or compared to goals, how the portfolio is done. And this is obviously all done on purpose. And again, when you see fee-based, to me, it is a specific effort to mislead the client in thinking that they're getting a fee-only planner.
Very interesting. And so from any of the fee-based type planners out there that you've ever run across or any of those types of programs, can there ever be a middle ground in your experience where they're not charging fee only, but they still are doing a reasonable fee that in regards to the return that they're issuing the client?
Josh, I'm sure there are. I'm sure there are ethical people out there. I have no doubt. I can't say that I've come across one so far, but I'm sure there are, as in every field. I think the problem is that you're setting the client is setting themselves up for failure. You're walking into an ethically challenged environment where, in a sense, that's, quote, fee-based or straight commissioned planner or advisor or broker is essentially it's you or them. It is the more they can extract from you, the client, the better their family does. I mean, I don't see how you can possibly end up doing well in the long run or beat the odds. It would be like in medicine if, when I was practicing full time, if you came to me and the antibiotic I chose to give you was based on how much the drug company was paying for the use of that antibiotic per week. Sure, I could remain ethical. I could give you the right one that's right for you and at the lowest cost, but the daily drip, drip, drip of incentive to do better for me is going to be tough to overcome in the long run.
That makes total sense. I like the way that you said that, and I appreciate you really delineating the difference between the two. Let's move on to another article that I found very interesting, and that article is titled Six Common Physician Retirement Planning Mistakes. Would you mind just giving us a brief review of that article and covering a few of the common mistakes that you see physicians making?
Sure. Well, I find that in general, it's one of the most powerful ways that physicians and other businesses can build wealth and retirement security is with retirement plans, because essentially the government is helping you, letting you deduct the contributions at a relatively high tax bracket, and then later when you take distributions, you're paying back in a much lower tax bracket for most retirees. And it's that both arbitrage of tax rates as well as the fact that your earnings get to go tax deferred for so many years, it's mm-hmm. just a spectacular way to build wealth. And so most physician and other physician businesses and other businesses have retirement plans, but I've seen some big errors that they cost them a lot of money. The biggest error is when they go to a bank or a brokerage company or a non-transparent investment advisor, and they get put into these plans that have very high costs, again, many of which are usually hidden. So there'll be mutual funds on many of the insurance company brokerage plans that they call it pay to play, that it's well known that these are mutual funds that no one would ever in their right mind buy because of performance and expenses, but they pay the insurance company a fee to be on the platform. And then you're stuck with those choices. And I actually see these all the time because I have people that work for big corporations, including physicians, and they're stuck with these terrible choices. The other mistakes that I see made are physicians and other business people will go to a brokerage house or an insurance company, and they'll end up with a plan that is very inflexible in terms of employee costs. It's just kind of a cookie cutter prototype. And you end up spending a lot more in employee cost and plan cost than you would if you went and got a customized plan with a third-party administrator and a transparent advisor. Mm. And then finally, probably one of the biggest mistakes I see is that people don't fund these plans aggressively once they're in place, or they start them very late. And starting early and saving aggressively is one of the strong keys to being financially secure later on.
Stephen, question for you. You mentioned that in your first point that there's these high cost plans that are underperforming the market, and that you have to pay to play to be on that platform. And so I'm just trying to follow the money there. Obviously, the client is getting a disservice and there's a premium being paid. But is that premium being paid to the employer, or is that being paid to the benefit manager?
Both. So I would bet that many of your listeners, if they pull up their plans, they'll see what I'm about to talk about. And they will see that they have a very limited number of mutual funds that they can invest in their retirement plan. And if they look at the expenses I've seen as high as 3% a year internally on some of the mutual funds. And what happens is because of these very high fees that the participants end up paying, the insurance company or brokerage will come to the plan sponsor, the employer, and say, we'll do your plan for free, okay? Because they're getting these kickbacks from the mutual fund companies that essentially cover all the costs and profit. So it's very appealing to the sponsor or company or practice, but there is no free lunch. And of course, these plans, not only they are expensive, but they tend to be plans that, again, no one would ever buy.
Interesting. So the employer may not be actually getting a direct check, but they're getting some sort of service or benefit in terms of waived fees. Scary.
Correct.
I'm going to pull out my 401k statement as soon as we hang up.
you can almost guarantee that almost every 401k plan I've seen that has an insurance company attached to it, you know, Manulife, a John Hancock, Prudential, that's the kind of general structure you'll see going on.
So let me get your advice on that then, because let's say that I go into the account where I've got my 401k allocated, and in fact, I pull up my statement and I see these high fees in the 200 to 300 basis point range. What is your advice for someone that is in that situation?
Well, there's two points of advice. One would be if you're in a smaller company, I would go to the employer and say, you know, this is really not a fair and good plan. Is it possible you would look into a different, you know, company, maybe one of the no-load companies like Schwab or Fidelity, or a third-party administrator custom design plan that could use low-cost investments. That would be point number one. If, however, you have an unresponsive plan sponsor or you're in a very large company, they're not going to listen to you. Then what I will do is recommend that you see sometimes there's one or two of the funds that is an index fund and very low cost and kind of just slipped in there. And what I will tell people to do is invest around that. So put the bulk of your 401k or other retirement plan money into that plan, into that fund, and then invest your outside funds, you know, non-retirement plan funds in the other asset classes that you want.
That's great advice. Very good advice. Thank you for that. Okay, so let's talk about one of your other points, which is don't start early enough and don't fund aggressive enough. And that's one of the common themes on our podcast. And so, you know, having traveled the journey as a physician and been at this for several decades and worked with many, many physicians, tell us a little bit about the counsel or advice that you give, particularly young physicians. Let's talk about folks either coming into residency and fellowship or are very newly attending, and what do you tell them?
Well, I tell them that they want to try and live well within their means. That's perhaps the most important advice I can give them. So what you see is, you know, during residency, you're not making a lot of money. It's hard to save, and it's probably not crucial at that point. What is crucial is to make sure they have, you know, life insurance if it's appropriate, and disability insurance to cover, you know, catastrophic problems. And this, but what I tell them as soon as they get out and their income jumps is to immediately get used to living on well below what they're making. Because it's a twofold benefit. One is that it lets you save a lot from the very beginning. And second, it keeps you from getting used to spending most of what you're making, which becomes an increasingly severe problem as you, you know, get more and more experience and have higher and higher incomes. So I'll tell young physicians, you know, and pretty much all young clients, I'll say you should be trying to save at least 20% of what you make, you know, kind of from day one, if not more. And if you can do that over a long career, you're certain to do well in terms of having some retirement security.
I think you nailed it in terms of timing and in terms of the importance of hitting it early. And the reason that I wanted to park on that, Stephen, is that I think, and I've found myself make this same mistake where the emotional payoff, the emotional return of buying something, whether that's a car or a boat or what have you, some sort of luxury that maybe I didn't really need, you can get addicted to that. You can get so connected to that emotional charge, and you see people do it all the time. Maybe they describe it a little bit differently, but you know, you get a letter in the mail that you're going to get a pay raise, and before you bank the first check, you've bought the new car. That's a tie to an emotional charge, and that's an emotional gratification through purchase. Alternatively, you can develop the same sort of emotional charge from savings. And I think the pattern that you're talking about is so important to identify in oneself and understand why I do what I do and why it is that I'm out, you know, planning the next expensive car in anticipation of the money coming in and how that's tied to an emotional charge. But it can also be offset by starting early with savings and seeing how that account starts to grow and then having some success in that. And very soon, what I've found in myself particularly is that the emotional charge from saving, not spending where I could, and then watching my nest egg grow and watching my money start to work for me It's a much stronger emotional charge. But if you never get started down that path, the behavior is hard to break.
Yeah, that's excellent advice, Josh.
All right. Well, thanks for bringing that up. Let's transition. As I was reading, your background is so diverse, but I was thinking of a story. You know, my mother is a retired attorney that practiced landlord-tenant law and asset protection for her clients, primarily for landlords and business owners. I've heard hundreds of stories about good landlords and business owners who lost their assets due to one insanely frivolous lawsuit or another. So I've been scared to death by the concept of frivolous lawsuits and losing your assets. And I think that physicians particularly need to have a higher understanding of those risks and take steps to protect their assets. And so I wondered if you'd walk us through your article titled, Are You Protected? 6 Common Mistakes Made by Physicians.
Sure, Josh. So, you know, as you stated, the physicians should have, in general, a very high attention paid to asset protection issues, obviously primarily due to malpractice risk. It's a somewhat unique risk in a unique profession that is a severe problem in many states, especially in Florida, for instance, where I practiced. Just about every physician I've ever met practicing in Florida has had at least one lawsuit. It's an incredibly common problem, and asset protection is key. But there are other reasons to worry about asset protection. And with anybody that has any substantial assets or future income, I find that almost all of the families I work with, it's a significant issue, whether or not it's appreciated. And I do see a lot of mistakes in the planning process and in follow-up made that I think, you know, need to be paid attention to. And getting good, impartial advice is crucial. So some of the things I went over in the article is I see 2 big mistakes in families with asset protection issues. One is that assets are titled in a way that expose them to creditors. So the most common way you see this as an accident is just owning something by yourself rather than jointly in many states where a certain type of joint ownership gives you really good asset protection against individual creditors. Mm. So the classic example would be a physician wife and a non-physician husband. The physician wife puts all the assets in the husband's name to keep them away from malpractice exposure. But now you have all these solely held assets held by the non-physician husband exposed to his risk, to their joint risk, and tongue-in-cheek to divorce. Everything's owned by the other party. And instead, they really would have been fine for the most part just owning it together or in a structure than having it in a single person's name. Mm-hmm. But along the same lines, one of the biggest mistakes I see is people think that their revocable living trust offers them asset protection. So I will commonly see, you know, families go, oh, well, our stuff is held in trust, so it's protected. Well, a living trust, which is what pretty much everybody's talking about, is revocable, meaning you can put things in and take things out, and so can a judge. And it offers you zero asset protection. I find families are consistently surprised by that, but it's in fact a truth. And given a lot of the changes in estate tax law in the last few years and such, there is very little reason for high-risk people and families to own things in living trusts until they're very advanced in age, in my opinion. Now, I can't practice law, but in terms of the balance between protecting assets and estate planning, that's my opinion. People also think corporations protect their assets. So a physician will say, well, I'm incorporated in my practice, so I've got asset protection. Well, that really protects your assets zero. It is protecting you from liability of the other shareholders, perhaps.
Right.
But it offers no personal asset protection. And then perhaps one of the the biggest mistakes people make also is not to have enough insurance, not to risk share. As you can go into the market and pick up $1 million of what's called umbrella liability insurance, which covers you for all risk other than your specific business, you know, whether it's automobile risk or homeowner's risk or non-specific general risk. You can pick up this insurance for, you know, $300 per million per year. And families will sometimes have not enough or none. And that's an issue we usually address right away.
So how do you recommend holding assets? Or I don't know that your scope goes that far, but maybe it does. And so if I was a physician client and I had maybe a primary, a secondary, and maybe a rental property, or I owned the building that my office was in, how would you advise, or how have you seen those assets most successfully titled and protected?
Well, usually what I see people do is they seek to separate the liability of real estate from their other personal assets, especially if the real estate is rented. So you have, you know, another tenant there, whether it's a rental condo, a rental home, whether it's a vacation home that's rented, or your office. And so you would like not to have a creditor of that particular real estate be able to come after your other personal assets. And so what we'll see commonly done is these real estate is put into a protective structure, like a limited liability company, or even sometimes a family limited partnership or such. So that's probably very, very commonly done.
And, you know, I think the thing with asset protection is that you have to decide how much protection do you want, because there's oftentimes an equal amount of headache that is associated with the protection. So in other words, you know, in my family, we hold our different rental units in family limited partnerships. And so, you know, we've got 136-plex in one partnership, and we've got a small group of homes in another. And of course, the business entity that's producing income is in another. And all of a sudden, you turn around and you realize you're filing taxes on 27 different businesses, and you've got 32 different checking and savings accounts. What have you seen, or what counsel would you give in regards to what's enough, and how have you dealt with that personally?
Well, it's a very individual decision. It's a good question. So it really depends on what you think your level of risk is and how much hassle you're willing to take. So, for instance, you know, to give specific examples, if you have a vacation home that only you use, you probably don't need a protective structure. Mm-hmm. But if you have a condo on the beach and you're renting it out weekly to a bunch of different people, I think that's an inordinate amount of risk to assume in your own name. And I would usually recommend talking to an attorney about, again, a limited liability company or like you have family limited partnership. In many states, the LLC structure is really simple. It doesn't require meetings or a lot of documentation once in place. You know, it's $150 a year to renew with the state, and it surprisingly can offer a great deal of separation between you and the real estate.
I think you said that perfectly. That was a great way to wrap. So, Stephen, thank you so much for your time and for sharing so generously with our listeners today. If our listeners want to find out more about you, the services you offer, and maybe they just want to dig deeper in some of these articles that we've just scratched the surface on today, how do they go about contacting you and getting some more information?
Well, Josh, the easiest way to see the articles or to contact me would be to go to the website, which is www.wealthcarellc, it's spelled WEALTHCARELLC.com. And the contact information is there. And there's a lot of articles there to look at as well.
There are a lot of articles. There's some great information up there. Stephen, thanks again. It was a pleasure. And we look forward to connecting with you again soon.
Thank you, Josh. Thank you very much.